Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, breaking news, banning flavored vaping. President Trump says he's moving toward a sweeping crackdown on tasty e-cigarettes that are so popular with teenagers after a series of vaping-related illnesses and deaths. Why is the White House getting involved? Noah's snark. We're learning more about the administration's efforts to undermine weather officials and defend the president's false claim about the hurricane threat to Alabama. Did Mr. Trump know his acting chief of staff intervene? Mr. Tough Guy. That's how the president is describing his ousted national security advisor, accusing John Bolton of making very big mistakes. Their feud escalating today on a day when America's security should be front and center. And remembering 9/11, the nation pauses to mark 18 years since the nation was attacked as it never had been before. Tonight, we honor the fallen and the heroes.
Bradley James Best.
We want to welcome our viewers in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Breaking news tonight on the Trump administration moving toward a ban that would impact a very lucrative industry and potentially the health of many young Americans. The president declaring he wants to get flavored e-cigarettes off the market. Vaping products have been linked to a growing outbreak of severe lung disease and at least six deaths. Also breaking, a White House official confirms that acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney played a key role in defending the president's claim that Alabama was threatened by Hurricane Dorian. We're told Mulvaney directed the Commerce Department to fix the problem and disavow forecasters who contradicted Mr. Trump. I'll get reaction from Senator Angus King. He's an independent on the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. And our correspondents and analysts are also standing by. First, let's go to our chief White House correspondent, Jim Acosta. Jim, as the president made his big announcement on vaping, the ouster of John Bolton was still very much on his mind.
It certainly was, Wolf. President Trump is still justifying his decision to fire John Bolton, saying the former national security advisor made some, quote, big mistakes before he was kicked out of the administration. The president trashed Bolton in front of the camera, saying even North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un wanted nothing to do with him. The president made these startling comments just as he was announcing his administration is considering a sweeping ban on flavored e-cigarettes.
Vowing to tackle the epidemic of teen vaping, President Trump announced his administration is finalizing a new policy to crack down on flavored e-cigarettes, noting even the First Lady is urging federal regulators to take action.
We can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved.
But the president had one other ban on his mind, as in his decision to fire his national security advisor, John Bolton.
John's known as a tough guy. He's so tough he got us into Iraq. That's tough.
Mr. Trump fired off the first rounds of what's shaping up to be a war of words with Bolton.
And I told him, John, you have too many people. You're not getting along with people. I'm sure he'll, you know, do whatever he can do to, spin it his way.
The president defended his decision to give Bolton the boot and part over his handling of North Korea.
He made some very big mistakes when he talked about the Libyan model for Kim Jong-un,
insisting the now former national security advisor was wrong to suggest that dictator Kim Jong-un could be handled in the same way as Libyan ruler Muammar Gaddafi, who was overthrown after giving up his nuclear ambitions.
I don't blame Kim Jong-un for what he said after that, and he wanted nothing to do with John Bolton.
But a source close to the White House said Bolton was leery of Mr. Trump's dealings with dictators and is worried about what will happen if he sits down with Iran's leaders, saying, quote, John doesn't really like the idea of a meeting because it's his view that Trump caves. He gives them way too much.
This could be one of the most unbelievable experiments ever, North Korea. And I also say the same with Iran. Iran can get back to business.
The White House is still cleaning up after the president's mistaken claims that Hurricane Dorian posed a threat to Alabama. A White House official confirmed Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney spoke with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to have his department disavow a tweet from the Birmingham office of the National Weather Service that contradicted the president. Mr. Trump told reporters he didn't instruct Mulvaney to do that.
No, I never did that. That's a whole hoax by the fake news media.
The acting head of NOAA, which issued a statement backing away from that National Weather Service tweet, reassured forecasters they're not under attack.
No one's job is under threat, not mine, not yours. The Weather Service team has my full support and the support of the department.
Earlier in the day, the president marked the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks and discussed his recent decision to host the Taliban at Camp David, a summit he scrapped.
We had peace talks scheduled a few days ago. I called them off when I learned that they had killed a great American soldier from Puerto Rico and 11 other innocent people. They thought they would use this attack to show strength, but actually what they showed is unrelenting weakness.
Now, while the president is taking action on e-cigarettes, it's not clear where things are headed on new gun safety laws. The president spoke with both Democratic and Republican senators about the potential for new gun control legislation earlier today. Mr. Trump is still not committed to the idea of universal background checks, despite polls showing such a system is supported by nearly all Americans. The president told reporters at the White House earlier today there are some things that, quote, will never happen. Wolf.
All right, Jim, thank you. Jim Acosta at the White House. Also tonight, the House Judiciary Committee is just hours away from a very key vote setting ground rules for its impeachment investigation. Our senior congressional correspondent, Manu Raju, is joining us from Capitol Hill right now. Manu, as Democrats head into that committee vote, are they on the same page when it comes to impeachment?
Well, Wolf, as more and more Democrats say that the House Judiciary Committee is currently conducting an impeachment inquiry, top Democratic leaders do not have the same message. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier this week on multiple occasions when I asked her whether or not she believes they're in an impeachment inquiry, she said it's simply a continuation of the investigation that already has been ongoing. And today, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said no when he was asked whether or not the committee is actually conducting an impeachment investigation. Now, he later issued a statement saying he supports what the House Judiciary Committee is doing, but he would not call what was happening an actual impeachment inquiry. And I just asked Hoyer again whether or not he believes they're in an impeachment inquiry. He also would not say. He referred back to that statement. But overall, what Democrats are saying, Wolf, is that they do plan to move forward with this investigation and ultimately could still decide about whether or not to recommend articles of impeachment to remove the president. But listening to Democrats over the last day, they're not on the same page.
He has said that it's an impeachment inquiry. Is he right?
I don't speak for my colleagues. What matters most to me is, do we meet the definition required to get grand jury material in court?
I want to see every Republican go on the record and knowingly vote against impeachment of this president, knowing his corruption, having it on the record so that they can have that stain on their careers for the rest of their lives.
Doing the same thing we've been doing. We're trying to ferret out the truth.
There's an old adage about how to cook a frog. If you throw it in boiling water, it jumps out. But if you put it in lukewarm water and turn on the heat, it'll swim around until it gets cooked. And my sense is the speaker is cooking the president.
And the speaker has endorsed what the House Judiciary Committee is doing, including the vote tomorrow to set the ground rules for how impeachment hearings could take place in the future. That includes allowing the chairman of the committee, Jerry Nadler, to actually call hearings that he would call impeachment proceedings. And we could see that next week, Wolf, when Corey Lewandowski, the former Trump campaign manager, is expected to testify about what was outlined in the Mueller report, those allegations that the president may have tried to thwart the investigation, Wolf.
All right, Manu, thank you. Manu Raju up on Capitol Hill. Joining us now, Senator Angus King. He's an independent. He's a member of the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. Senator, thanks so much for joining us. What did you make of the president's decision today to once again trash his former national security advisor, John Bolton, in the Oval Office of all places, even going so far as to side with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un over him?
Well, it's an odd scene, Wolf, because you remember that John Bolton was hired by the president. I mean, it's an odd situation where the president is dumping on the person that he brought in to that very important position. I think really, though, Wolf, we got to look forward and see who's going to get this job in the future. It was apparent to many of us from the beginning that the president and John Bolton were going to go in different directions. I don't think the president wants a war with Iran, for example, and I think John Bolton has been very hawkish about Iran for 10 or 15, 20 years. He's been pushing in that direction. So I don't think this decision was surprising. What is a little bit surprising is this he said, she said, or he said, he said, that we're hearing from the president. It's I don't know. I don't know what to say. Unbecoming, I guess. If he wants to make that decision, that's fine. It's his call. The National Security Advisor is not confirmed by the Senate. It's entirely within the president's discretion. I hope he gets somebody in that job who's going to collect the information throughout the government, give him good advice, and tell him not necessarily what he wants to hear, but what he needs to hear.
Yeah, Bolton, for years, has been saying he wants regime change in Iran. The president doesn't necessarily support regime change in Iran. He's ready to meet with the President Rouhani at the United Nations General Assembly in the coming days.
I think the Iranians would be crazy to miss this opportunity. It's clear that the president wants to meet. He's made that clear. Mike Pompeo has said it without preconditions. There's sort of a pause in the friction right now. This is an opportunity for the Iranians to get out of this maximum pressure situation and to try to reach some kind of deal with the United States that hopefully will go beyond the deal that the president abrogated last year. I think the real question is, what's that deal going to look like? Is it truly going to be better than what we had before? Like I said, I think the Iranians are missing an opportunity if they don't try to take advantage of this offer of talks.
Yeah, the president, he really wants to meet with him without any preconditions. As you correctly point out, it was Bolton who opposed any such meeting. There's been a lot of turnover, as you know, in the president's national security team. Some very important positions are currently filled by acting officials. Does that have a negative effect on U.S. national security right now?
Well, I think it does. You've got vacant positions. You've got people in acting positions. There are people throughout the government in acting positions that, we're not following the constitutional process where people who require Senate confirmation, they're being made active. They don't get ever sent to the Senate. But I think, you're trying to deal with very, very, very complicated issues when you're not fully staffed. And, I think one of the problems with the firing of John Bolton, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, I wouldn't have hired him in the first place, but one of the problems is you're sending a message to your staff, to the national security folks, don't tell me what I don't want to hear. And that's a dangerous message for a leader to send, because anybody makes mistakes, and if you don't have staff and people around you who are telling you when you're going off in the wrong direction, those mistakes can be very serious. So that's what's bothering me about this back and forth that's going on this afternoon.
Very important point. Senator, you just returned from a visit to Saudi Arabia, where I understand you confronted the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on the murder of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We're showing our viewers a picture of you and your colleagues meeting with the Saudi leader. What can you tell us about that session? How did he react?
Well, I can tell you that it was a very direct session. Todd Young, Senator Young from Indiana, and I were there. It was a long, substantive meeting, well over an hour. He reacted. We didn't know how he was going to react. We knew we were going to confront him about this issue. He wasn't surprised. He reacted in a way that he understands, Wolf, that he's got a problem. He understands that he's got a problem with the American people, and that this matter has to be dealt with in a straightforward and transparent way. They've started a trial process for a group of people that were allegedly involved in this murder, but they've left out Al-Qahtani, one of the top aides who's not in the trial, who we believe should be. And then, of course, he's the head of state. Whether he ordered it directly or not, he's responsible for what takes place on his watch. And I think he needs to come forward and say that publicly to try to get us beyond this issue, because the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States goes back 80 years, and it's very important, not so much for oil anymore, but because of the tenseness, the complexity of the situation in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is a strong bulwark against Iran, which has expansionist desires in the whole region. So Saudi Arabia is an important ally, but the Crown Prince knows he's got to come be straightforward about this Khashoggi.
Well, you spent an hour with him, Senator King. You clearly looked him in the eye. Do you believe he ordered the murder of Khashoggi?
I don't know. I don't know, Wolf. There's no evidence that he did. But, you know, the issue is, if he was the head of the government, and how would he not know? On the other hand, this may have been one of those situations from Thomas à Becket, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest?" where a leader makes a statement, and the followers, in the case of Thomas à Becket, it was the king's knights, went off and killed the bishop. Now, you know, who knows? I don't know if we'll ever know the answer. And I could not form a final opinion on that, but I can tell you, I put the question to him very directly.
But you're on the Intelligence Committee, the U.S. Intelligence Community, as you know, the director of the CIA, they've all concluded that he was responsible for the murder of Khashoggi. Do you disagree with that assessment?
No, they concluded that based upon his control over the government of Saudi Arabia. In other words, there's no intelligence that I know of that links him directly to the action. But what their conclusion was, that a sparrow doesn't fall in Saudi Arabia without the prince's knowledge and involvement. And I think, you know, that's really the issue. So, you know, I think this is a very serious issue. And as I say, I think he has to come forward and be straightforward about it, and at least take responsibility as the head of state. It happened on his watch.
But with with a high degree of confidence, the CIA concluded that he ordered the murder of Khashoggi. Do you disagree with that intelligence assessment?
I don't disagree with it. I like I say, that intelligence, I'm aware of that intelligence assessment, and it was based upon the way the government of Saudi Arabia works. It wasn't based upon an intercepted communication or some evidence of his direct, and I think that's a reasonable assumption. But you asked me the question, do I believe to a certainty that he did it? And I can't give you that certainty. I think it's likely, for the same reasons that the CIA thought it was likely. He does not take that responsibility, but I think, as I say, at least he needs to take responsibility for the fact that it happened with him as the leader of the country.
Yeah, that's a very important point, and lots at stake in terms of U.S.-Saudi relations, as you well know, and all of us know. Senator King, as usual, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Wolf. Good to be with you.
I'm glad you went to Saudi Arabia. Just ahead, President Trump says he fired John Bolton. Why does he feel the need to explain his decision and bash Bolton along the way? And we'll take a closer look at the epidemic of teen vaping and the health risks prompting the move to ban flavored e-cigarettes. President Trump is delivering party shots at his ousted national security advisor. He's again slamming John Bolton as a so-called tough guy who made some, quote, very big mistakes. Let's bring in our analysts and our experts to discuss. Abby, you cover the White House for him. Why do you think the president feels the need on this, the second day, to continue to slam him?
Well, according to my colleague Caitlin Collins, they had a falling out, an actual argument in the Oval Office. And so it's clear that they left on pretty bad terms. Bolton is also known to not really go away quietly. And I think the president seems to understand that. And he's pushing back early and pretty aggressively in a way that I've not seen him do with virtually anyone else who's left the White House, at least not this immediately. Usually he tries to put a positive spin on things. This time around, ground. I think he's trying to really push back on Bolton and make it very clear that this was a disagreement about approaches and about ideology, and that that he's basically saying, I'm in charge here, and this is the direction I'm taking my foreign policy.
I think we can expect, David, a very firm, tough response from Bolton.
Yeah, I mean, Bolton has one advantage here that a lot of people who depart the administration don't have or haven't had, which is that he knows what he thinks. A lot of people disagree with him. Maybe most people disagree with him, but he's not shy about expressing a more hawkish foreign policy view. So if he has disputes with the president on issues, on strategy going forward for the United States, I don't think there's any reason to think he'll hesitate to share with the world what he thought and why they disagreed so strongly. On the other hand, he came into the administration late and could have easily known that it was going to end like this, with a dismissal on Twitter, with the president trying to get out in front of the narrative to make it look like Bolton was the one who was incompetent rather than a strong, as you say, disagreement.
I never understood why he brought him in to the White House, Jackie, to begin with, given their very different positions on so many issues.
Well, right. So the role of the National Security Advisor is to advise the president on big decisions when it comes to national security and foreign policy. And if the president doesn't trust that person's judgment, then what's the point of them being there? And with Bolton, his views are so opposed to what the president's are. It really does beg the question. I mean, he had an op-ed that I think the title was, "We Need to Bomb Iran." So the idea that there was a surprise that he was so hawkish and really wanted to bomb Iran, it's puzzling. It's like someone didn't do their homework.
Jeffrey, the president today blasted him once again for supporting the Iraq war, which the president said he opposed.
Well, and that was years ago, which everyone knew. I mean, Bolton was a famous neoconservative hawk, very supportive of the Iraq war. And just as you suggest, then why did he hire him in the first place? I mean, the idea of criticizing Bolton now for supporting the Iraq war, well, that's a reasonable position to take, but that's a longstanding fact about John Bolton. And, you know, he just simply couldn't have, he should have not hired him in the first place. I mean, the whole thing is very mysterious.
Well, he used to be a regular analyst on Fox News, and the president watches a lot of Fox News. He used to see him over the years. I assume that was one of the reasons he decided to bring him in.
And I firmly support the idea of television analysts being appointed to very high positions in the government. Clearly, that's one area where Donald Trump and I agree, because the president seems to do most of his recruiting from Fox News, not so much from CNN and MSNBC, strangely enough. But I mean, the fact that that people are on television is something that really appeals to him.
Let me get your thoughts on this other issue, Jeffrey. Then I want to move on to our other experts over here. The acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, clearly played a role in getting NOAA to disavow the National Weather Service tweet that contradicted the president, who insisted Alabama was endangered by the hurricane. The president said today he was unaware of Mick Mulvaney's involvement. What do you believe?
Yeah, right, is my position on that. Look, you know, the president can never be seen to be wrong. That's one of the guiding principles of this administration. It is one thing that the North Korean administration of Kim Jong-un and the dear leader of the United States have in common. And there was this tremendous mobilization from the Secretary of Commerce, from the White House, to try to persuade that the people in Alabama who were doing their job trying to protect the people of Alabama did something wrong. This is a shameful episode. It is a completely unnecessary controversy. But the fact that the White House was behind it has to be the least surprising fact of the day.
Abby?
Yeah, it does seem that this is just another example of White House aides, particularly Mulvaney, thinking that the easiest way out of a situation in which the president doesn't want to look bad is to make everyone else around him change their narrative to fit whatever he's said. Now, sometimes the consequences of that are benign, but in this case, there are real consequences. It means that a lot of people now have reason to question the things that are coming out of government agencies that are designed to keep people in this country safe, that are designed to provide accurate information to the public. And they're doing it all because Mick Mulvaney and others in the White House want to just simply stop the president from being upset with White House aides and upset with the coverage that he's getting on television.
I don't know why the president couldn't have said, well, originally we thought Alabama was in danger. It was no longer in danger when he said it was. But he doesn't like to do that, as we know. Everybody stand by. There's a lot more we need to discuss on all the breaking news right after this. We're back with our analysts. Lots to discuss. Jackie, this is the 18th anniversary of 9/11. The national security advisor is now gone. There's an acting national security advisor. There's a whole bunch of acting national security types serving right now at a time when potentially there could be some major national security threats. How big of a problem is this?
You know, 9/11 is one of those days that reminds us how vulnerable we truly can be in this country. So the fact that there is a lack of permanence in the upper echelons of the national security apparatus, yeah, that's troubling. And you would hope that Congress would confirm people and the president would appoint people to those jobs that were not only qualified, but also that, you know, had the ability to stay there for more than 10 minutes to have that that continuity.
I never understood, Abby, maybe you did, why the president decided on the eve of the anniversary of 9/11 to invite the Taliban leadership to Camp David. The Taliban has never condemned what Al-Qaeda did on 9/11.
Yeah, it really is puzzling. And it's puzzling that he brought it up again today, of all days. I mean, you have to wonder if the president really did think it was a bad idea. I mean, clearly a lot of people around him thought it was a terrible idea,
including Bolton.
And for that reason, the president has cited that as one of the many reasons why he and Bolton didn't see eye to eye. It seems that President Trump is much more interested in just getting to some kind of deal than making sure that the conditions are right, making sure that something like inviting the Taliban onto U.S. soil is something that he can have public support for. So, it's a little bit tone deaf, but it's not surprising that President Trump would kind of just barrel through without really thinking through all the consequences.
What do you think, Jeffrey? Why do you think he was willing to bring these guys over to Camp David?
Well, I think the Camp David and the anniversary are terrible ideas, but I would just like to offer a word of support for the idea of negotiating with the Taliban. You know, you can't make peace with your friends. You have to make peace with your enemies. And, you know, the Taliban are terrible people. But, you know, is the alternative to keep American troops in Afghanistan forever? Is that something we want? I mean, you know, Richard Holbrooke, the advisor to Obama, years ago wanted to start negotiating with the Taliban. I mean, this is not a crazy idea in and of itself. And I think, you know, the surrounding circumstances of Camp David and 9/11 have sort of colored this debate, when in fact the idea of trying to reach some sort of agreement that brings some level of stability to Afghanistan is not in itself a terrible idea.
You make a very important point. The U.S. Special Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, for months and months, has been meeting, fully authorized by the president, with the Taliban to come up with a deal. And David Swerdlick, I think they were getting closer and closer. My own sense is they were on the verge of some sort of deal. The president wanted to bring him to Camp David so he could potentially claim credit for nailing it all down.
They were getting closer to a deal, but I see two problems here, just going back to what Jeffrey said. First of all, President Trump has a habit of rushing ahead to the finish line because he likes a big photo op before building all the building blocks of a peace deal that he needs. And if you compare this to the situation with his negotiations with North Korea, I think you see something similar. He crossed over the 38th parallel because it was a big splashy moment, even though the deal that he wants to build with North Korea wasn't in place. He thinks Camp David, and he's of a certain age to remember Prime Minister Menachem Begin and President Anwar Sadat with Jimmy Carter and the famous handshake photo. He wants that, Wolf. And he's proposing something like a meeting with the Taliban on U.S. soil, because that's what sells. That's what has a photo op, not the actual.
But remember, Abby, when President Jimmy Carter invited Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Anwar Sadat, the President of Egypt, to Camp David, this was after Anwar Sadat, the leader of Egypt, had gone to Jerusalem and addressed the Knesset and uttered the words, he wants to make peace with Israel. Right. At that point, Jimmy Carter picked it up, and they met at Camp David.
This is exactly the kind of thing that John Bolton saw in President Trump repeatedly, and felt like he needed to be a bulwark against that, that he felt that President Trump always wanted to get to the negotiating table, was willing to give too much and not get enough in return. So it's not an unfounded concern that people would have had that the president would have come into a room with these parties and would have given away the store, because he seemed to be willing to do that in other cases. And in the past on North Korea, Mike Pompeo and others convinced him to walk away from a bad deal the last time that they met face to face for an actual negotiation. It's not clear that they would have been able to do that this time around. And I think that's one of the reasons why this relationship really broke irrevocably just days after that meeting with the Taliban was called off.
Your thought?
You know, and to your point, I mean, we don't even know that all the players were at the table at this point when it comes to Afghanistan and the Taliban. Rushing to the end, the president didn't want this to be a celebration. He wanted it to look like it was all coming together because of the stagecraft of it all, which, again, the stagecraft is part of the problem here because they were going to come on U.S. soil. So, yeah, it's problematic. And he wants that photo op and do anything to get there.
Everybody stick around. There's more we need to discuss on all the breaking news. The president and the first lady, they're now warning of the very serious health risks from vaping, especially for teenagers. Will the new move to ban flavored e-cigarettes save lives? Tonight, the vaping industry is bracing for a major crackdown. The Trump administration is moving toward a ban on flavored e-cigarettes that are especially popular with teenagers. This comes after hundreds of cases of vaping-related illness and at least six deaths across the United States. Let's bring in our senior medical correspondent, Elizabeth Cohen. Elizabeth, how significant is this announcement today from the White House?
Wolf, this is for sure a very significant announcement. Anti-smoking advocates tell me that they really think that this could make a big difference. Basically, what the administration is saying, those candy-flavored, fruity-flavored, minty-flavored e-cigarettes that have been so popular among young people, that they will ban them. There is one important note. After they ban them, companies such as Juul, which is the big player here, they're allowed to apply to the FDA to try to remarket them, put them back on the market. So there is a possibility they could come back. The advocates say, boy, we hope that the administration makes it clear that the answer to all of those applications will be no. All of this news is on the heels of some really awful news over the past couple of weeks. The CDC says some 400 possible vaping-related illnesses across the country, and also in addition to that, six deaths. Most of these have been among really pretty healthy young people.
I understand, Elizabeth, you had a chance to speak to an 18-year-old whose vaping habit almost cost him his life.
Right. We met with Adam Hergenrigger in Illinois. He was a healthy 16-year-old, was doing great, was athletic. He started vaping, regular vapes, and then he started doing marijuana vaping. And he all of a sudden, at age 18, became desperately ill.
I had the shivers and I couldn't control it, so I would just randomly convulge, and it was really scary. I knew it wasn't a stroke, but it felt like that because I couldn't control myself.
Now, we've been hearing about these illnesses from so many people, Wolf. I mean, these are healthy young people who, after vaping, end up sometimes in the intensive care unit on ventilators because they can't breathe on their own. And it's a bit of a mystery. What exactly is it in these vapes that is causing these illnesses? And are they in all e-cigarettes, only in certain kinds? That's what the CDC and others are trying to figure out now. There are so many different chemicals in e-cigarettes. Which ones exactly are causing these problems? Wolf?
Very important announcement from the White House today. Elizabeth Cohen, thank you very much for that. We have a lot more news right after this. We're following the lead up to Israel's unprecedented repeat election 6 days from now. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fighting for political survival against challenger Benny Gantz. CNN's Oren Lieberman has more on the heated election rematch.
His victory speech on election night in April came too early. But next Tuesday, Benny Gantz has a second chance to do what he couldn't do then, defeat Benjamin Netanyahu. At Gantz's campaign events, his supporters chant, "Look who's coming, the next prime minister." After trying and failing to beat Netanyahu the first time, Gantz is vowing to pull out all the stops.
We're continuing to work to approach the people.
That's what is needed until the end and beyond.
Even those who support Netanyahu realize Gantz is, on paper anyway, a formidable challenger.
I'm realistic. Even though I come from Bibi's camp and I will vote for Bibi, I see the political map and I know the center-left will form the next government.
But analysts say his campaign has lacked a message and argue Gantz often comes across as lackluster, leaving some here wondering if he really wants it.
There might be a secret in his very inept campaign in the sense that it presents such a counter to Netanyahu.
Gantz was a career soldier, rising to become Israel's 20th chief of staff. He led the military through two wars in Gaza, serving under the man who's now his rival. Netanyahu has painted Gantz as inexperienced, passive, incapable of running the country and handling world leaders. He says Gantz is a leftist who'll form a government with the Arabs.
The choice is between a weak left-wing government led by Gantz or a strong right-wing government led by me.
But in April, Gantz's blue and white party pulled in a million votes, falling less than 15,000 votes short of Netanyahu's Likud party. When Netanyahu couldn't form a government for the first time in the country's history, he called new elections instead of giving Gantz the chance to lead the country. If Gantz wants that chance this time, he's going to have to fight for it. Do you feel confident, I ask?
I feel excellent.
For a soldier who made it to the top, this may be the fight of his life. Oren Lieberman, CNN, Jerusalem.
And just ahead, 9/11 remembered. Finally tonight, we honor the 2,977 men, women, and children who died on this day 18 years ago. At the 9/11 Memorial in New York, we saw a ritual so familiar and still so moving. Victims' names read by family members, including sons and daughters saluting parents they've grown up without.
Ronnie E. Geese.
Andrew Cleve Gilbert.
And my father, Edward Calderon, who will forever live in our hearts. We miss you, and we love you dearly.
At the other sites of the attack, more solemn tributes. Former President Bush laying a wreath at the Pentagon, as President Trump had done earlier. And Vice President Pence in the field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where a hijacked plane was brought down by brave passengers. To all those who suffered and are still suffering, to all those who were heroes, you are, of course, in our thoughts on this day and on all of the September 11th anniversaries to come. Thanks very much for watching. Aaron Burnett on Front starts right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.